What's going on, everybody? It's Slay Diddy, a.k.a. Professor Slay, a.k.a. Mr. WGXC, and you are listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. Listen in, y'all.
I'm Roe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. Again, we have a busy show this morning with all kinds of breaking news and interesting stories. We'll hear about the fire that broke out at the Norlight plant in Cohos yesterday. And our friends at WOOC in Troy have an interview with Drug Policy Alliance New York State Director Melissa Moore about the possibility of marijuana being legalized in New York State in the New York legislature in Albany this year. We'll also hear about the shortage of vaccine doses, as local counties say they would be giving out many more shots if they only had more vaccine. We'll also hear the national headlines from the Public News Service, the Better Weather from the Catskill Makers Syndicate, and the local news and more on this final day of President Donald Trump's presidency on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
And the moon turns to blood. The stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. The stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network.
This is the news.
This is the network.
This is the news.
This is the network.
WGXC welcomes audio responses from listeners. Anyone can call and leave a message with WGXC, and we'll play it on the air. Call 518-291-WGXC and leave up to a 3-minute message for airplay. Hear something you disagree with? Want to speak out on an issue? Plug your band's show? Let your neighbors know something important? Call 518-291-9492 and leave a 3-minute message anytime about any issue. That number again is 518-291-WGXC. 518-291-9492.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Powell Leather Items of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that if you want to get a vaccine shot for COVID-19, there are limited times to register. Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro explains that his county expects 600 doses this week. And so on January 18th, they began taking reservations and, quote, all appointments filled within minutes, unquote, he said. Ulster County sees a similar situation. Quote, we expect to receive vaccines on Wednesday, and we are in the process of scheduling individuals who had their appointments previously canceled, unquote, Assistant Deputy County Executive Daniel Torres wrote in an email. Molinaro said that they could be ending the pandemic sooner if they just had more vaccine. Quote, although we have the capacity to vaccinate thousands of residents each week, we can only vaccinate as many people as we receive vaccine doses for, unquote, Molinaro said. Quote, we will continue to push for more vaccine, but in the meantime, we are dispensing every dose we get to eligible residents quickly and efficiently at our vaccination centers, unquote. In Columbia County, officials expect 400 doses this week rather than 300. Columbia County Department of Health Director Jack Mabb said Columbia County is getting extra doses because its pharmacies don't have doses to give to seniors. Meanwhile, there are 48 new COVID-19 cases announced January 18th in Columbia County and another death. The state web tracker for coronavirus reported 30 new positive tests in Greene County January 18th. Ulster County reported 114 new cases of COVID-19 on January 18th and one more death. Dutchess County had 212 new coronavirus cases and six more deaths. Rensselaer County had 109 new cases on January 18th, and Albany County reported 172 new positive cases, three more deaths, and a record 180 hospitalized. Plus, 51 inmates and 22 staff are COVID-19 positive at the Albany County Jail.
Leah Snyder is reporting for Columbia Green Media. With four public hearings down, there is at least one more to go concerning the proposal to install six Verizon 4G antennas on Providence Hall on Columbia Street in Hudson. The application was submitted for a special use permit by Bell Atlantic Mobile Systems, LLC, on behalf of Verizon Wireless to install and operate wireless communication equipment on the roof. The public hearing began at the October 27th Planning Board meeting and has continued at the board's monthly meeting. Concerns have been raised over radiation health impacts, which the Planning Board is legally not permitted to consider. Michael Musso, a senior project manager and risk assessor at design firm HDR, said the board can make decisions based on visual impacts, code compliance, structure assessments, and cultural resources. Musso has served as a consultant for the Planning Board throughout Verizon's application process. Scott Olson of Young Somer, Attorneys at Law, a Verizon representative, emphasized that the company's plan is in full compliance with Federal Communications Commission requirements. He said the plan will only emit 1% of the radio frequency radiation emissions the company can legally use. Alexandria Simchenko, a Hudson resident who has made several presentations in opposition to the antennas at the hearings, asked why city-owned properties closer to the waterfront were not being considered and expressed continued concern over lighting and high winds near Providence Hall. Providence resident Glenn Roney said, and I quote, "People don't choose to live or visit here because of the quality of cell phone service," end quote. Calling the antennas, and I quote, "soul-crushing," end quote, and I quote, "ugly, out-of-place variable," end quote. He argued that the negative impacts the antennas would bring to the city would outweigh the benefits of improved service from Verizon. The hearing will continue at the Planning Board's February meeting. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
Alelia Schneider is reporting for Columbia Green Media that in an extraordinary move, Hudson Common Council President Thomas DiPietro has eliminated council committees for 2021, significantly altering the structure of city government. In lieu of separate committees populated and managed by the alder people, department heads will now report to the full council at its informal meeting. Ad hoc committees will be created to address specific issues that need more time and public debate, DiPietro said. The change is experimental. The changes mean all resolutions and laws will go through DiPietro, who will set the agenda and lead the ad hoc committees. Representatives of the Hudson Development Corporation, the Hudson Community and Development Planning Agency, and the Downtown Revitalization Initiative Committee will also report directly to DiPietro. Quote, "centralizing all these things will lead to greater participation and openness of government in the long run," unquote, DiPietro said. None of the 10 Alder people chose to discuss the changes at the organizational meeting last week before they unanimously voted to accept the rules of order, despite many not knowing about the planning in advance. In 2020, the council had 9 committees, each made up of 4 members, including the committee chair. Zoom meetings have gotten out of control, with online attendees misunderstanding them as public forums, DiPietro said. The structure will bring something different for the new year. Majority Leader and Second Ward Alderperson Tiffany Garriga, who chaired the Housing and Transportation Committee, said, quote, a new style, if you will, for 2021, unquote, she said. The council will see if the setup works to decide whether or not to continue it for 2022, she added. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media. The town of Coeymans will hold a public hearing on January 28th to gauge local reaction to proposed updates to the community's comprehensive plan. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, the hearing will be aired on the town's Facebook page and on Mid-Hudson Cable Channel 901. Town Hall will be closed to the public because of the increasing number of virus cases. Speakers will be able to present comments via telephone at 518-756-6006, extension 3. Comments can also be submitted to the town's clerk office via email at townclerk@coymans.org. The draft of the town's plan update was completed in December. According to the document, and I quote, the town has experienced significant industrial growth in recent years and seeks to update the plan to strike a balance that supports industry while maintaining and enhancing residential areas and natural resources, end quote. MJ Engineering and Land Surveying worked with the town to develop the update, which focuses on economic development, infrastructure, transportation, natural resources and agriculture, land use and zoning, and government administration and policies. If approved, the comprehensive plan, first formulated in 2006, will still stand, and the update will serve as an amendment to the original. The draft comprehensive plan update can be found at coymans.org. And you can read the full story at the Ravenna News Herald.
Rick Carlin is reporting for the Times Union that a fire briefly broke out Monday, January 19th, at the Norlite Aggregate Plant in Cohos. Authorities believe that spilled fuel outside of one building led to a brief fire starting shortly after 11 a.m. No injuries were reported, and Cohos City firefighters had it out within 20 minutes, Fire Captain Jason Geary said. Norlite spokesperson Prince Knight noted that the facility immediately implemented its contingency plan and contacted the city fire department. Quote, once the fire was extinguished, facility personnel immediately notified both the Department of Environmental Conservation and Cohos Mayor Bill Keeler. The incident is now under review by Norlite's Environmental Health and Safety Engineering and Operations Departments, unquote, Knight said. Quote, the Norlite team wishes to thank the Cohos Fire and Police Departments for their immediate and professional response, unquote. Norlite has been in the news for the past year when it was learned the company had been incinerating potentially toxic PFAS compounds in the company's kiln, which produces shale rock into construction and road building aggregate. Burning of the compound has since been banned under state law. WOOC's Alexis Goldsmith spoke to a nearby resident, Jennifer, about the fire on Monday.
So, basically, before I got in the shower,
yeah,
I don't have my mask on.
It's okay.
You can smell it. This smell that I'm smelling right now, it smells like,
Yeah, that was it.
You can smell it. It smells like something burning. I kept it. It was making me sick. Like, it stinks.
Yeah.
And I kept saying, before I got in the shower, I said, what are they burning now?
Right.
Because the smell, you can smell it. I'm just, I don't know what they're going to do, you know.
Right.
But I didn't know it was on fire. I knew I smelled something. Yeah. I still smell it.
They had a fire, yeah.
That's what I'm smelling.
You don't mind if we're recording it, right?
No, I don't mind. But now it's crazy that you're telling me that, because I smelled something earlier that it did not smell good.
Right.
It was something that I said, this is, what is that?
Were you inside when you smelled that?
I was inside, but my window was open upstairs.
Yeah.
So it came right through my window, and I was sitting there, and I got in the shower, and I'm just like, this smell, it stinks. It smells like, Like,
I think it smells like a dry erase marker.
Yeah, it's like something really stinky, yeah. And now I don't smell it as strong, but it was definitely, I smelled it a lot. I still smell it, though.
Yeah, no, if you go over there, it's
worse. That's toxic. Like, I don't know, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't understand why, you know, it shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be there, or we shouldn't be here.
Right.
You know, I keep saying that, and it's like they're not, I understand that it's a process with everything, but I feel like they're not moving fast enough. Like,
this is a question. Do you feel safe knowing, like, you have no idea what was possibly being hurt?
No, I don't. I do not feel safer. And literally, when I smelled that earlier, the first thought in my mind is like, see, here, this is what, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Every time I smell something from over here, I'm like, I got to get out of here. It's pushing me more and more to get out of here. Like, I want to get from over here. You know, like, me and my kids, we should not be breathing this type of stuff in. You know, who knows what stuff they have over there, you know, or the chemicals on top of, you know, whatever that they found. And it's coming in our windows. We're breathing this in. We're right here. We're living right here. So it's very toxic for, we should not have to live in this environment. We should not have to breathe in any of that stuff. It should not be here. It shouldn't be here. That, the factory itself shouldn't be here, or these housings shouldn't be here. Families, children, babies. I have kids in here. We should not be here.
Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Kenneth C. Crow II is reporting for the Times Union. Republican Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin is facing a potential challenger in Skodak resident Democrat Gwen Wright, 65. Wright is a retired executive director of the State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence. McLaughlin has launched his 2021 re-election campaign with a $238,000 war chest. Wright says she plans to raise $200,000 to $250,000 for her run. Wright, who was recruited to run by the progressive Rensselaer County Women for Change organization, said, and I quote, "I'm very confident that we'll get it," end quote. She would be the first black woman to run countywide. Wright's challenge now is winning the endorsement of the County Democrat and Working Families Party organizations. The Democrats hope to select a candidate by early February. Richard Crist, the county director of operations and a GOP political operative who worked on McLaughlin's campaign in 2017, said the campaign appreciates the financial support received to date and the fact that many are recognizing McLaughlin's work reducing taxes 3 consecutive years, paving more than 100 miles of roads, supporting historic job creation, a bond rating upgrade, and a compassionate and comprehensive response to the COVID-19 outbreak. Wright said she will be campaigning on protecting the county's environment, including water resources, taking advantage of the county's Hudson River frontage for quality of life for residents, and building the tourism industry, developing infrastructure that will benefit residents, and pursuing economic development. She also wants to help local businesses in recovering from the coronavirus pandemic, having seen for herself by working in a woman's clothing store how devastating the pandemic has been. And you can read the full story in the Times Union.
Nick Reisman is reporting for New York State of Politics that approximately 30% of New Yorkers responding to a Siena College poll believe race relations in the state are good or excellent. And views have changed little in the past year, according to data collected and released by Siena College on January 18th, the official commemoration of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. The poll found a combined 31% of state residents think race relations are excellent or good, while a combined 64% say race relations are fair or poor. The split is identical to what Siena found in June 2020 after protests against racial inequality and police brutality in cities nationwide. According to the Siena poll, the Black Lives Matter movement has dropped in favorability since the spring protests, falling from 66% favorable to 56%. 33% of New Yorkers polled have an unfavorable view of the movement. Meanwhile, 48% of New Yorkers believe that the Black Lives Matter movement has had a positive impact on the country, while 32% disagree. 13% believe the movement has had no real effect. Politically, 77% of Democrats view the movement favorably. Two-thirds believe it has had a positive impact on America. But 62% of Republican voters view the movement unfavorably, as do 44% of independent voters. The poll of 804 registered voters was conducted from January 10th to 13th. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 37 degrees. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low of around 23. And on Wednesday, a slight chance of snow showers, partly sunny with a high near 29 degrees. And Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low of around 15 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. In Greene and Columbia counties.
Hello and welcome to the Better Weather for Tuesday, January 19th. 25 degrees in West Durham to 28 in Bull's Head is the morning low temperature range. Winds stay light today and cloud cover will be thick. Temperatures max out at 39 degrees around 2 p.m. Overnight, conditions stay calm as temperatures fall to 23 degrees. Just after dawn tomorrow, some light patchy snow is expected, ending by 2 p.m. Winds get stiffer, reaching 15 miles per hour, and temperatures max out at 34 degrees. Thursday and Friday looking dry with highs in the 30s. Today's tide schedule is low at 1:34 a.m., high at 7:41 a.m., low again at 2:01 p.m., and high again at 7:52 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:38 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:15 a.m. Looking way up, we see a northern and a southern coronal hole are releasing streams due to strike tomorrow into Thursday. Solar wind speed is currently 312 kilometers per second at 12 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 13. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Greene County's Mountaintop Cares Coalition has announced it once again offering training to administer naloxone and Narcan, the saving drug used to reverse opioid overdoses. The medication is easily administered by a trained person. The training is virtual and takes approximately 2 hours. It will be held online from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Thursday, January 21st. All participants will be issued a Narcan kit upon completion of the training. To register, write naloxone at mountaintopcarescoalition.com or you can call 518-487-1788. The Coalition is a nonprofit organization that serves people with substance abuse disorders and issues of addiction in the mountaintop communities of Greene County. Its mission is to promote recovery and empower those we serve and their families through advocacy, referrals, education, and peer support.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tammy Dillon of Germantown, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we track the transition in uncharted territory. President-elect Joe Biden loaded boxes of food to honor Martin Luther King Day yesterday. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris also volunteered. President Donald Trump issued three executive orders, one to make permits easier for judges, prosecutors, and law enforcement officers to carry concealed firearms. Another rather ambiguously protects Americans from facing criminal punishment for unintentionally violating regulations. And a garden with statues of heroes, which needs congressional sign-off. Trump's expected to issue scores of pardons and commutations in the final hours of his presidency, but not so far for his family and himself, according to Fox News. The Biden-Harris inauguration is expected to be light on in-person public attendance tomorrow and heavy on security. Biden's expected to quickly issue dozens of executive orders himself, many to reinstate policies from the last administration, including canceling the Keystone XL pipeline permit. Before attention is on Trump's Senate impeachment trial, Maria Teresa Kumar, head of the Voto Latino Foundation, wants voting rights to stay front and center.
People are going to try to restrict voting. What we want to make sure is that we create uniform methods of voting across the board and so that it's clearly defined and clearly accessible.
Kumar spoke at a recent National Task Force on Election Crises media briefing. She emphasized the need to stop many of the voter suppression practices seen in the last election and reduce the influence of big money in politics.
There's already talk of H.R. 1, which is a modernization of elections that the last Congress passed.
H.R. 1, the For the People Act, was just reintroduced. It passed the House in 2019, but lost then in the Senate. Chirag Baines from Demos details provisions to expand voting rights.
It would require automatic voter registration so that if you're interacting with government through your DMV or by requesting public benefits, that you also get registered to vote in that process. And that's automated, moving the burden from the individual to the government.
H.R. 1 would prohibit voter purges, adds Baines, require the option of online and same-day registration so you can still register on election day, and also replace partisan gerrymandering with nonpartisan commissions to draw electoral districts. A big job. Now that the 2020 census is done, redistricting will start. Yesterday, the U.S. Census Bureau Director Stephen Dillingham announced his resignation. He faced criticism for pressuring statisticians to document the number of people in the U.S. illegally. Sandra Chen at the Princeton Gerrymandering Project analyzes voter data to show where gerrymandering likely occurred.
There are a couple of states that particularly stand out from the last cycle because they actually created a situation of minority rule where the party that won a minority of the statewide vote share won a majority of the statewide seats in the legislature.
She highlights North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Virginia. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Ross-Brautelum. Thanks for listening.
So today is a very important day. We celebrate and honor the legacy of milk. Okay, milk, one of our great patriotic beverages. Very white, very tasty. Sort of everybody, maybe you aren't right. You look like you were raised on formula, but I was raised very strongly on milk. Not from my mother, but she paid some people to breastfeed me because she said she didn't want that. But, you know, that's strong Trump compassion right there, strong Trump compassion. So everybody has the day off today to honor milk. I don't think the leftists, the radical socialists, should have it off because they're out there going, we don't need milk. You know, you can leave the cows alone. You can have... Look, here's some acorns. We're going to put this in a machine and we're going to make acorn milk. That's what they're selling at the supermarkets. That's what I've been told. Acorn milk. You know, look at this. We found some twigs. We're making twig milk for the radical leftists, okay? But real Americans, we know we love our great milk, even though Joe Biden is going to destroy our milk farmers. He wants to kill dairy. He's going to, you know how I pardoned the Thanksgiving turkey very strongly. Joe Biden is going to slaughter milk cows on his first day. That's what he's going to do. But we're not going to do it today. We honor milk very strongly. Love it. And our dairy farmers, they never did so well until I showed up because I supported milk. Okay? What's that, Mike? No, not you, Pence. We're done with you. Pompeo, you're now in the room. MLK, For black? He was a black? Okay, well, chocolate milk then. We love chocolate milk almost as much as white milk. So, you know, we support all milk except for the fake radical left, acorn milk. That's not real milk. So now to honor milk, I'm going to go golf. And to honor chocolate milk, I'm using African-American caddies today. So we'll see what happens.
There are reports that privately, Melania just wants to go home and cannot wait to get back to New York. So what are the First Lady's future plans? Over the years, she's appeared on the show numerous times. And tonight, she wanted to come back and make another official announcement. So here with an exclusive message to the nation, one last time, First Lady Melania Trump.
Thank you, Stephen. I have spent the last 4 years serving in the White House. But all good things must come to an end. Also, this. And the tragic events of the last couple weeks, as well as all of the ones from all of the years before, have made me realize I need to think long and hard about what I should do next. Okay, thought of it. I'm ditching that loser. And moving back to New York, baby! It's so good to be in NYC. The bestest city on earth. The huge apple. The city that never sleeps with a porn star that lies to you about it. Being here makes me feel, which is something I don't normally do. Hey, New York. New York, have you missed me? Just as much as I missed you. Pretty town, home to pretty people, and also you, my home. Here I am, it is your Melania. I'm all yours, lovely NYC. In New York, with all my New Yorkers, who can't wait.
You suck.
Wear a mask.
Oh. You suck.
Such colorful characters with their local expressions. I'm walking here. Forget about what. There goes my driver. Nice to see you, Jeffrey. New York is too good to be true. No one puts me in a rage. Asking about kids in a cage. I don't really care about that. Not here, but I can spend this money, and I'm beloved when I go out.
She's completely nuts.
We hate her freaking guts.
I'd hate to be the fun they're talking about. Okay, so she doesn't like my husband. Who does? I'm with you, sister. I mean, that could be any Melania. Okay, that one actually seems kind of personal. Starting to wonder if New York dislikes me. What is this word complicity? That riot on the mall hurt Melania most of all. No one in Earth is bullied more than me. Sometimes I dream I stayed in Slovenia. Some goats, a farm, the simple life.
can change your mind and say you love me if you want to. I'm so glad to see you go. I might even pop a bottle of champagne. Hope they arrest you, lock you up, but we all know that the you're through will leave a stain. 4 years of you felt like a decade in reverse. 4 years of you, low-level devil's wicked curse. 4 years of you, you made the virus even worse. Pack up your fans and take the evil that men do. We need a medal for living through 4 years of you. I won't hate you. I don't want you in my mind. Going forward, I'll pretend you don't exist. And when they rate you as the worst one of all time, what does it mean if they just slap you on the wrist? 4 years of you was watching God take in the piss. 4 years of you and thinking, do we deserve this? 4 years of you, we'll throw a party in our heads with all the family and friends who didn't live to see the end of 4 years of you. We need a medal for living through 4 years of you.
Here's a 2021 song from Hudson's Buke and Gase and So Percussion, who are partially based on the Bard College campus. The song is called Ancient Tool Gadget.
We'll be right back.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC correspondent Corrine Carey spoke with Drug Policy Alliance New York State Director Melissa Moore about the possibility of marijuana legalization in New York this year.
Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Governor Cuomo came out in his first State of the State address, first in a series of State of the State addresses, and announced that he was making legalizing adult use cannabis a priority this year. In fact, he said that it is something that he has always favored, despite the fact that, you know, there are differences of opinion about how supportive the governor has been. What's your reaction to this announcement?
You know, I think it's clear that it's long overdue for New York to move forward with legalization and regulation of marijuana in our state for adult use. It's been the case now for many years that New Yorkers favor legalization by a 2-to-1 margin, and that's true across all areas of the state. And actually now we have a majority of Republicans in New York that support legalization as well. This is no longer a third rail type of issue as it once might have been, but it's rather like really the opinion of what New Yorkers want to see happen. And so, you know, from my perspective with Drug Policy Alliance and our work with the Start Smart Coalition, which is the main organizing entity working to pass marijuana legalization in New York, it's much less a question of whether or not New York should legalize, but what that will actually look like in practice and what the framework will be for legalization. And we like to use the term marijuana justice because that really centers the components that are crucial in our opinion around making sure that we're addressing the impacts of prior criminalization and the way people have lifelong consequences, making sure that we're establishing an industry that's equitable and diverse and inclusive in New York State, and also making sure that there is community reinvestment of cannabis tax revenue, especially in light of, you know, the impacts of COVID hitting a lot of the same communities that were the hardest hit by the marijuana arrest crusade, making sure that those resources are actually getting to the folks and the neighborhoods and communities that have been the most marginalized and most need the help to rebuild and bounce back from multiple layers of crises.
Are people still getting arrested for marijuana possession, and what does that look like across the state?
What we see across the board are extreme racial disparities in who is the target of enforcement of marijuana prohibition. Unfortunately, this has been the case for decades now, that, you know, despite the fact that people in New York and across the country use cannabis at pretty similar rates in different racial and ethnic groups, the people who are the most targeted consistently for arrest and for enforcement are Black and Latinx New Yorkers. Despite the fact that we've seen arrests drop quite a bit over the years since our advocacy has really ramped up to end the marijuana arrest crusade, unfortunately, the racial disparities have actually increased within that time. And so it's certainly an issue that we still need to grapple with and is one that is urgent to make sure that we're establishing justice truly across the board for New York.
I keep thinking about disparities because they abound in so many different ways, right? Because New Yorkers that have a car and the time and the money can go right across the border and go to one of the very easily accessible dispensaries in a neighboring state like Massachusetts, for example. And I also think about how some lawmakers that I've spoken to have said, you know, this will help us to get rid of the underground market, or we'll get rid of street dealers. Getting rid of street dealers, what does that actually mean?
That's a great question and a really important point. So one of the absolutes for us within the Start Smart Coalition is having multiple entry points into the legal market and into the regulated market that actually could provide bridge points for people who are already participating in the legacy space. You know, we do not want to repeat the mistakes of when New York established the lottery, for example, that really upended numbers and took money essentially out of communities that had been really vital for people just being able to earn their livelihood as they had been blocked out of participating in the formal economy in a lot of ways. And we still see structural barriers day in and day out that end up being tremendous hurdles for people who are just trying to be able to earn a wage and support their families. And so what we're calling for is for there to be opportunities like micro licenses, like co-ops, and different entry points into the regulated market in New York. So it's less a conversation about demonizing certain groups or talking about the illicit market in disparaging terms, but rather being clear that that has been a survival tactic for a lot of folks. And instead of offering criminalization, which has not been effective and has led to a lot of the disparities that we've been talking about, it would be a far better approach from a justice perspective and just from an economics perspective to be able to make sure that folks have a place within the regulated market and having those bridge points in.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Melissa Moore, the New York State Director with the Drug Policy Alliance. I'm just wondering, is it even realistic to think that, you know, an average person in the Capital Region who sells marijuana to friends, family, acquaintances, is it realistic to imagine that that person might be able to make it in a new regulated market?
So that's exactly what we want to make feasible. And one of the big components of that that is centered within the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, which is the bill that's been pending in the legislature since 2013, is an incubator program. And that really takes into account the fact that people who are going to be social equity licensees within the new cannabis market might have varying degrees of support that would be helpful for them in terms of, you know, making sure that they're not signing a lease that is exploitative if they're going to be having an actual brick and mortar dispensary, or making sure that they're compliant in terms of all of the payroll and tax components that are necessary, as well as crucially having access to low and zero interest loans to be able to stand up these businesses. What we've seen in other states that have social equity programs is they might give a priority license to social equity applicants or have some other rubric, but without the actual financial resources behind that of having low and zero interest loans available to people, you run into this hurdle over and over again where, because of federal prohibition, that means that people can't access the same types of, you know, small business loans that people in other sectors might have as they're seeking to start out a business. So it really leaves folks in a bind if they don't have tremendously deep pockets or access to huge amounts of, you know, hedge fund capital, which is not most New Yorkers. And so figuring out a system where we have social equity licensees as well as an incubator program that is funded from the very outset, so that people are not losing market share out of the gate to large corporations. You know, we want to make sure that this market is comprised of cannabis that's grown in New York by, you know, family farmers as much as possible and sold in, like, kind of mom and pop shops. You know, we don't want Walmart weed in New York. And so being really intentional about the framework for the program is absolutely vital.
Are there models to look to? Are there other states that have done it right?
I think this is where New York has a big opportunity. You know, we're behind 15 other states that already have legal access for adult use, including South Dakota and Montana. So this is, you know, again, no longer such a fringe issue. And certainly our neighbors in New Jersey, who just had the residents of the state to approve their ballot question in November, allowing adult access. And yet, I don't think there really is a state that's gotten it right, per se. I think there are a lot of lessons learned and a lot of recalibrations and adjustments that New York can actually make and that the sponsors of the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act have made over the years with the bill to really hone it and take into account, you know, what we've seen that has kind of sort of worked in other states or worked quite well. Some of those really, like, the headline areas where New York has the opportunity to truly be a leader for folks across the country is when it comes to the social equity components of legalization and having dedicated community reinvestment.
Who opposes legalization of adult use cannabis in New York at this point? Who stands in the way of this becoming a reality in 2021?
I actually don't think that there are very many stakeholders who are wholly in opposition to legalization anymore. I mean, you might have some holdouts here and there, but by and large, the fight around legalization is really centered much more on what the framework will be. You know, will there be components like a lockbox guarantee around cannabis tax revenue for impacted communities? Will there be licensing opportunities for microbusinesses and for people who don't necessarily have the connections to folks with wallets stuffed full of cash? That is really what it's coming down to, is not so much, again, a question of whether New York should legalize, but really framing the discussion around what are the necessary aspects of legalization to be able to get this over the finish line. And that's frankly what it's come down to in the last couple of legislative sessions. It wasn't the merits of legalization. It was actually the different angles and components have to be included in order for us to get this right. And the legislature deeming that what was on the table didn't accomplish those goals sufficiently. And you know, here we are again with another try. So there are groups in the state, you know, particularly the PTA, have come out in opposition to legalization. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of what they point to in terms of their rationale for being opposed doesn't track with what we've seen in other states. So there's a lot of kind of kicking up a storm about, you know, youth use rates and, you know, what are we possibly going to do amid a vaping crisis with our young people, which, you know, frankly, we're quite concerned about as well. But we also recognize that prohibition is not the most effective tool to deal with these sorts of issues. It's much more effective. You know, we know from our experience with bringing down teen pregnancy rates and dealing with alcohol abuse among young people and teenagers, that actually giving young people the tools to make critical decisions and giving them actual sound science-based information to be able to determine what decisions to make and to not make is much more effective than straight up prohibition. And so Drug Policy Alliance, for example, has a curriculum that we've developed working with teachers across the country called Safety First that is really rooted in building those critical thinking skills, giving young people the information that they need to make a risk assessment, and then actually building the practice of being able to navigate these situations and, you know, keep themselves and their peers safe in a way that they recognize is much more reality-based than, you know, the kind of old DARE model of just saying no, which, you know, when young people see their peers, you know, using marijuana and the sky doesn't necessarily fall for them, you know, they kind of throw it out with the bathwater. Like, why do I need to listen to this? It's clearly not linked to what my reality is. But instead, you know, if we were bringing this out of the shadows, and, you know, the MRTA actually does have dedicated resources and funding for drug education, and particularly among young people, we can give them tools to make wise decisions and work within that sort of behavioral health model, which is actually proven to be much more effective. Unfortunately, what we've seen across the country is that as legalization has moved forward in various states, youth use rates have actually remained pretty much consistent across the board. And we're actually seeing that, you know, the same is true for, you know, DUIs and things of that nature. A lot of the areas of concern for people can actually be much more effectively handled with information and with consumer education than with just a prohibitionist mindset, which, you know, we've seen for the last 50 years of the war on drugs has not been effective. And so it's time to turn the page and actually operate from a playbook that has shown to work much better in these areas and address concerns. Anybody who wants to learn more about marijuana legalization in general, or also how to be part of making sure that New York passes legalization the right way with marijuana justice, can visit smart-ny.com. That's the website for the Start Smart campaign, which stands for Sensible Marijuana Access Through Regulated Trade. And there will be a ton of information there and ways to sign up to get even more linked into our efforts.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Here's Artificial Authentic, a 2021 track from Mouse on Mars.
The best part of love is the thinnest slice. It don't count for much, but I'm not letting go. I believe there's still much to believe in. So lift your eyes if you feel you can. Reach for a star and I'll show you a plan. I have figured it out. What I needed was someone to show me.
You know you can't fool me. I've been loving you too long.
What's going on, everybody? It's Slay Diddy, a.k.a. Professor Slay, a.k.a. Mr. WGXC, and you are listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. Listen in, y'all.
The Framework Show is back on the radio with new episodes Tuesday, January 19th at 3 p.m. on WGXC. The Framework Show features field recording, phonography, and the art of sound hunting from Patrick Tubin McGinley. This week, tune in to hear works from Louis Ashton, Maja Ristic, Francisco Marino, Haley Silvestri, sounds from the Apuri Maps, and an intro from Ben Link Collins on The Framework Show, 3 p.m., Tuesday, January 19th, at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Bob Wills Architecture of Rhinecliffe, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Joint Newscast, January the 19th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. As Joe Biden assumes office this week, he'll appeal to a nation facing multiple crises. Mike Moen talked with a Wisconsin professor who studies presidential speeches and who says Wednesday's inauguration could be a launching point for promoting a resilient democracy.
Biden has tried to focus on unity in light of a contentious election in which President Donald Trump issued discredited claims about voter fraud. That led to his supporters storming the Capitol, along with polls indicating many Republicans still not acknowledging Biden's win. The University of Wisconsin's Allison Prash says Biden could establish some healing by sticking with unity and restoring faith in democracy and not putting attention on himself.
He is a spokesperson for democracy, but he is not the definition of what our democracy is.
She says that compares with Trump's rhetoric of one person being the focal point of government. Beyond the inauguration, Prash says Biden's actions in this area could help cement some healing. She adds that he could also win over support by staying honest about the state of the pandemic, the economic struggles facing many Americans, and the need for accountability related to the riots.
Meantime, CNN reports the dissolving of one of America's most enduring transfer of power rituals, the outgoing president welcoming an incoming president on the steps of the North Portico, and then riding with them to the U.S. Capitol. CNN notes that it is just one of the snubs the Trumps are perpetrating as they leave Washington. Instead of a president and first lady, the Bidens will be greeted by the White House chief usher, Timothy Harlath. Harlath turns out to be a 2017 Trump hire from the Trump International Hotel in Washington and will likely not stay on in the Biden administration, a source said, noting that a role of chief usher in all probability will be filled by someone more familiar with the incoming president and first lady. An annual report examining social, economic, and environmental impacts on the nation's health shows the number of Virginians suffering from mental distress increased dramatically between the years 2014 and 2019, and that's even before the pandemic.
The state's 27% rise compares with just 11% nationally, according to Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare, which put out America's health rankings. She says that number measures people who said they felt down or depressed 14 or more days out of the last 30. She points out that folks likely have become even more troubled since COVID-19 hit last spring.
We do know from other reports that rates of suicide and rates of drug death overdoses in 2020 were up. So that is concerning. I expect to see that many measures in this report will be affected by the pandemic, particularly the socioeconomic measures.
I'm Diane Bernard.
This is PNS. Legislators, advocates, and experts are gathering today virtually to brainstorm solutions for the myriad threats facing Connecticut's environment.
The 21st Annual Environmental Summit, which coincides with the start of the new legislative session, Lori Brown with the event sponsor. The Connecticut League of Conservation Voters says revamping the state's recycling program is a high priority.
We've now gone from being the state that started the bottle bill, a landmark law, to a state whose recycling rate is under 50%.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
And Kentucky's felony theft threshold has remained unchanged for more than a decade. Critics say it is contributing to a rise in incarceration.
The dollar amount of property damage or theft often determines whether or not a person is charged with a felony. For decades, Kentucky's felony theft threshold was $300. In 2009, lawmakers bumped it up to $500. Criminal justice reform advocates such as Amanda Hall with the ACLU of Kentucky says the state's felony theft laws haven't kept pace with inflation.
If you receive a theft charge and the merchandise is $500 or over, you are charged with a felony conviction. In today's economy, that would mean a cell phone.
Recent legislation sponsored by a group of Republican lawmakers would increase the state's felony theft threshold to $1,000. Hall adds that felony convictions can remain on a person's record for a lifetime and lead to barriers in housing, employment, and education. People with felonies also are denied the right to vote. Felony thefts are expungible, but under state law, a person can't apply for an expungement until at least 5 years after probation and parole. I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Finally, Eric Tegadoff tells us that many women in Washington state are losing health care shortly after giving birth, a crucial time in a mother's life.
Senate Bill 5068 would extend postpartum Medicaid coverage from 60 days to 1 year.
The same measure was a victim of the pandemic in 2020. It passed with nearly unanimous support in the House and Senate, but was vetoed by Governor Jay Inslee because of budget concerns. Sam Hatzenbuehler with the Economic Opportunity Institute says the bill would help address the maternal health crisis.
Right now, about 10,000 women are falling through the cracks because of income or immigration restrictions.
Washington State's Maternal Mortality Review Panel found 30% of all pregnancy-related maternal deaths occur 43 days to a year after birth. The bill has a public hearing in the Senate Committee on Health and Long-Term Care on Wednesday. About 700 women in the U.S. die each year from pregnancy-related conditions.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener-supported, heard on some of the nation's most interesting radio stations, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Tom Rowe with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Since March, WGXC has been tracking every local county and their new case count as the coronavirus pandemic has raged. Every day we also note the number of local deaths, but today is the first day that all local counties have deaths to report. In Albany County, some of the seven new deaths from COVID-19 come from county officials just now discovering previously unreported cases. But the 257 new positive tests there reported January 16th in Albany County is not good news either. Across the Hudson River, there was another death in Rensselaer County and 117 new COVID-19 cases. Ulster County reported two more COVID-19 deaths January 16th, and Dutchess County announced four additional deaths. Ulster County also announced 155 new diagnoses, while Dutchess County said they had 197 new cases. Columbia County reported the 55th resident dying there, with 37 new cases January 16th and 65 new cases January 15th. Greene County, January 15th, announced four more deaths and 36 new cases. Delaware County had two more COVID-19 deaths January 16th and 18 more positive tests. Berkshire County also announced three new COVID-19 deaths January 16th and 78 new cases in the Massachusetts county. Amelia Teasdale is reporting for the Columbia paper that the Chatham Village Board agreed January 11th to hold a public hearing on a proposed local law that would abolish the village justice position, thereby dissolving the village court. The public hearing will be held next month. The board vote on the measure will be held after the hearing, and if approved, the court would be dissolved as of April 5th. But because of changes in state election law, if a petition circulated in opposition to the change after the vote receives the support of 20% of village residents, instead of sending the matter to the voters to decide, it would effectively kill the new law. The board would have to wait another 4 years to make the change. The village of Chatham is situated in the towns of Chatham and Ghent, each of which has a court where cases would be heard if the village court is dissolved. The public hearing will be held at 6:45 p.m. on February 8th before the regular village board meeting. The meetings are currently held online. Information on how to join the meeting is available at villageofchatham.com. Read more about the story in the Columbia paper. Alila Schneider is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the Hudson Development Corporation is again seeking developers for the still-vacant 4.56-acre CAS and CSX parcel in the city's first ward. Hudson Development Corporation Board President Robert Rosner said, quote, "We have no business owning undeveloped properties. It should be sold and put to good use for its new owners and for the citizens of the city," unquote. Rosner is of the opinion the corporation should divest itself of all real estate holdings because HDC does not pay real estate taxes. The board is expecting to receive $2 million for the property, he said. Three prospective investors have visited the site, but there are no proposals for the board to consider yet. The Wick Hotel, 41 Cross Street, leases a portion of the property for parking at present. CAS CEO Richard Katzman donated the property on Montgomery Street in 2010 to the HDC in exchange for a tax credit equivalent to the parcel's appraised value of $900,000. The idea behind the deal was to put the property into the hands of the agency that deals with job creation and finding developers, said former mayor and current Fifth Ward supervisor Richard Scalera. Quote, "Here we are 10, almost 11 years later," unquote, Scalera said. Quote, "Nothing has been done," unquote. CAS, the healthcare and home environment products manufacturer, announced the closing of its Columbia County site after 12 years in September 2008. the Hudson warehouses had been largely unused other than for storage at the time the businesses shuttered, Scalera said. Hudson Development Corporation Executive Director Branda Maholtz said, quote, to be frank, HDC right now is very cash poor, unquote. In 2017, the board did not like options presented for the site, Maholtz said. The community got more involved in 2018 and development stalled. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Monday, January 18th is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and the Daily Freeman has a rundown of how local services and offices will be affected. Amtrak will operate on its weekend holiday schedule. The banks are closed. County offices are closed. Federal offices are closed. The financial markets are closed. There's no service from Greene County Transit. Metro North will operate on its weekend holiday schedule. There's no mail pickup or delivery. Schools and colleges are closed. State offices are closed. Trailways will operate on its regular schedule with some cancellations. In the area, in Rensselaer, Andrea Smith and Dennis Murphy will present an hour-long virtual event featuring two women and showcasing strength, skill, and the loyalty of black women. The event will be held from noon to 1 p.m. Monday, January 18th, with speakers Gwen Wright, a potential candidate for Rensselaer County Executive, Ojuwana Wilson, the College of St. Rose graduate and design artist for the Biden, Harris, and Warnock campaigns in Georgia. You can register online for this at Color of Change. The link is available on the WGXC newsroom.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, January 19th. 25 degrees in West Durham to 28 in Bull's Head is the morning low temperature range. Winds stay light today and cloud cover will be thick. Temperatures max out at 39 degrees around 2 p.m. Overnight, conditions stay calm as temperatures fall to 23 degrees. Just after dawn tomorrow, some light patchy snow is expected, ending by 2 p.m. Winds get stiffer, reaching 15 miles per hour, and temperatures max out at 34 degrees. Thursday and Friday looking dry with highs in the 30s. Today's tide schedule is low at 1:34 a.m., high at 7:41 a.m., low again at 2:01 p.m., and high again at 7:52 p.m. Sunset today will be at 4:38 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:15 a.m. Looking way up, we see a northern and a southern coronal hole are releasing streams due to strike tomorrow into Thursday. Solar wind speed is currently 312 kilometers per second at 12 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 13. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Like a fire hydrant. Like a public drinking fountain. Like a park bench. WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
That was the Matthew Shipp Trio with Lynx from their 2020 album Piano Music. It's Matthew Shipp on piano, Michael Bizio on bass, and Newman Taylor Baker on drums. That was Bud Powell with Un Poco Loco on WGXC. That was Spring Hill Jack with Cheruscura, their Masses album. Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Hi, Lyndon. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
My name is Lyndon Kudlitz. I am a trainer and consultant primarily on LGBTQ issues with a focus in helping businesses, organizations, schools, New York State provide better services and atmospheres for transgender folks.
Back in December, the House of Representatives voted on a rules package that would govern the way that they do business on the House floor for the coming year. Part of that rules package was to adopt gender-neutral language for their own rules. And this has been blown up by right-wing media to kind of signal to their supporters that we're moving towards a society where a grandmother can no longer call herself a grandmother. Have you seen those rules, and what's your take on this situation?
You know, over a number of decades, we've been moving in this direction anyways, in a way that has nothing to do with transgender people, for example, right? I was a firefighter for 10 years, and, you know, the term is firefighter, and we moved away from fireman. We don't even need to use firewoman. We have a gender-neutral term. And that's just something that I think really is beneficial to everybody. And, you know, as you stated, these rules are not affecting people in their own homes and in their own needs, but rather it's the language that's being used in the kind of official words of government proceedings. And that makes sense.
Can you give some examples of what kinds of words these rules would change?
It changes things like, I think a great example that we often hear is, you know, the word chairman, right? And we also know that there are plenty of chairwomen, but really we can just say chair, and then we don't have to make that switch back and forth, and we don't need to pay attention to the gendering of it. And that way, when we always use the word chair in government proceedings, it pertains to everybody, and it just works across the board for every individual.
Some of the articles that I read about these rules make it clear that there are as yet no people who identify as non-binary in the House. So why do you think that the House adopted these rules?
I think the first thing that's important to note is that we don't have any people in the House right now that are publicly stating that they identify as non-binary. And so whenever there's kind of a first in government of some kind of person, I always like to say that it's that nobody has said it yet. It may very well be the case that nobody who is non-binary is in the House currently, but it does create an environment where somebody could step into the House with already having that language in existence. And again, I think this stuff is not just pertaining to non-binary people, but it really affects everybody.
There's something to be said for making a place welcoming for all people, though, right? I mean, even if you don't have any friends of color, right? You want to make sure that your language is non-racist. And even more than that, you want to make sure that your language doesn't promote white supremacy, for example. So it isn't really about who's in the House at all.
Yeah, you're spot on. I know that for me, when I'm, you know, thinking about a workplace that I want to be in, or quite honestly, even a family function, if the language that's being used among those people is accurately representing who I am and what I use in my life, then I can see myself there better, right? I can actually picture myself being a part of that and feel like I'm not just tolerated, but that I really have a voice and a seat at the table. And again, I mean that both professionally and personally in my own life. Language really does have a big impact. This is not about being PC. This is not about having more sensitive language. This is about not only being affirming of people's genders and identities, but it's also about being more accurate. If we can use language that broadens the scope of who we're talking about, so for example, just saying siblings instead of saying brother and sister, until we know that somebody might use the term brother or sister, then we actually include all siblings, including those who may not consider themselves brothers or sisters.
Kevin McCarthy, who's the Republican leader in the House, basically just said that what you said is stupid. He tweeted this out. He said, "This is stupid," signed a father, son, and brother.
And I think what he's calling attention to is his right to call himself a father, son, and a brother. And you talk about accuracy, and I think it's important to correct the record here. Nobody is preventing him from calling himself a father, son, and a brother. And in fact, the rules make that really explicit. That's important, right?
Absolutely. You know, if you were talking about your doctor, and I didn't know who you were talking about, I would probably say something like, oh, what did your doctor recommend? I would probably not say things like, oh, what did she recommend or what did he recommend? Although if I was only basing things on stereotypes, I might say, what did he recommend? But then as soon as you tell me who your doctor is, or you use a pronoun or language to talk about your doctor, then I know what to use. And so this is about keeping things neutral until we know what somebody uses for themselves. So that representative that spoke, not only does this not pertain to him in his own home, but it also means, great, now that I know that you have a son and that's the language you use, then when we're talking, I'm going to talk about your son instead of your child. But I'm not going to say son until I know that the individuals in your life that you're caring for, your children, use that language.
And just to be very clear, it's not just what Kevin McCarthy and others do in their own home. It's also what they do on the floor. Nothing in the rules prevents members from referring to themselves in a gendered way. It just doesn't do that. It's just about the rules.
Precisely. I think one of the things that I've been seeing as there are more laws and policies, guidelines that are put into place that create more neutral language so that it can include more people and so that, in fact, we make less assumptions, there's been that kind of resistance to it, right? And this idea that it's only a liberal thing or it is only associated with transgender and non-binary people. But I think that's such a misconception. So as an example, there was this post on Twitter from a teacher whose colleague was a second grade teacher and was talking about pronouns, and a parent overheard this Zoom lesson about the teacher talking about pronouns and tried to get the teacher fired and then pulled her child out of the school. The reason that the teacher was talking about pronouns is that it was a grammar lesson. It's interesting to kind of see, as we make more progress in creating spaces for all genders, there is this idea that talking about things like gender-neutral language, talking about things like pronouns, is automatically associated with that progress, when really, again, this benefits everybody and is just plain grammar education sometimes.
It's kind of signifies a kind of panic that we see in other areas of our civic dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people get really scared when government says you can or can't do something in your own home and in your own life. And I think that makes a lot of sense, right? We want autonomy over our bodies. We want autonomy over our beliefs, our values, our family, who we love. And I think that most humans have that desire. And what I like about, you know, moves like what the House is doing is that it doesn't at all impede on the autonomy of individuals, right? It instead expands the autonomy of individuals to be able to use language that works for them and to see themselves reflected in the place where they work or in the house that represents them.
Some people said that the House went too far. Others might say that the House didn't go far enough. Is this move enough to make trans folk feel welcome in places like the House of Representatives?
Just like using language such as chair instead of chairwoman doesn't magically mean that women have full equal rights in this country and that there's a lot of other things that need to be done. Using gender-neutral language and understanding the impact of pronouns and using the correct ones for individuals doesn't somehow make everything okay for transgender and non-binary folks. I think that when the focus of the needs of trans and non-binary people is on things like language and pronouns and just calling people the right thing, we also really miss the point that there are so many other needs, particularly the safety of trans and non-binary people, that are really crucial to people being able to, you know, live happy, healthy, thriving lives.
So the crux of, you know, even transgender movements is not call me by the right pronoun. It's I want to have a safe, happy, healthy life that is valued.
President-elect Joe Biden recently came out and said there are at least three genders. And I saw some commentators on social media look at that and say, well, he's getting there. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I agree he's getting there. I do think it's important to acknowledge that there are more than two genders out there. That is just factual. It's accurate. Just like, to be honest, there are more than two sexes. There are more than two ways human bodies exist. Now we're taught that there are only two, but that's not true. I make a comparison when I'm working with the attendees of my trainings. And that's that in the US, we have these two big parties, right? We have Republicans and we have Democrats. And they're the two parties that we hear about all of the time. They're the two parties that think about the most, the two ones we're pretty much given the options of, and the two that quite literally get handed the mic for debates. But when you really think about it, we also know that there are other third parties, not just one third party, but actually a whole variety of additional parties in addition to Republicans and Democrats. And yet those parties, plural, are not necessarily given the same platform, and we don't tend to think of them as really having a voice or being valuable or really in the game at all. And so we don't create spaces for them to exist, right? Gender is really similar, that we are given the idea of men and women, and that's all we tend to think about and what we're told are the only two options, when in reality, there are a whole lot of other ways, plural, that people feel about their gender, that people describe their gender, that the words people use for that, and those non-binary identities are not necessarily given the same platform, value, space, and voice.
It's been so great to talk to you about this. Thank you so much for giving me some of your time.
Thank you.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
And this is Ulster County's Medeski, Martin, and Wood. You're listening to the WGXC Morning Show live from Acre. I'm Tom Rowe. We'll be right back. from Woodstock way, that's Modesky Martin and Wood with End of the World Party and their 2018 release Alarm Will Sound.
This is Nature Note with Angela Gibbons of Earthwalk Vermont.
Today I'm feeling thankful for the amazing barred owl. Barred owls are large, stocky, grayish-brown birds of prey with notable, soulful brown eyes. They often sit quietly, swiveling their head, listening for prey. This time of year, barred owls eat mice, voles, squirrels, rabbits, and sometimes birds. They swallow most of their prey whole, digesting what they can and regurgitating pellets of fur and bones later. The barred owl is active year-round. However, this avian friend seems to be showing up more in recent weeks. This is hardly a coincidence. Barred owls are seen more often in snowy months. This is mainly for three reasons. One, food sources are beginning to diminish, or are hidden beneath the snow. As the owl searches for food longer and more frequently, they become more visible. Two, the mostly nocturnal barred owl will nonetheless come out to hunt on the gray, cloudy days that are so prevalent in winter. Three, they show up more against the white snow cover than in the more dense vegetation and more varied colors of other seasons. If you have not seen a barred owl, there is a good chance that you have heard one. They have many vocalizations. However, their most recognizable call sounds like, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? Go outside at night and listen."
Nature Note comes to you weekly from earthwalkvermont.org and Goddard College Community Radio.
Thelonious Monk and Sonny Rollins there with The Way You Look Tonight. Was Archie Shepp with Attica Blues on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.